Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. How are we all feeling? The morning after a brand new Star Trek movie. Yes. I hope you're as happy as I am, and I know that you are. So without further ado, let's bring in the cast of Star Trek Beyond. Simon Pegg, let's hear it, everybody. Joe Sunday. Chris Pine.
All right.
Zach Picotto. John Cho. And Carl Urban.
So my God, look at the camera.
Yes.
Wow.
Great color.
There we go.
Oh, whose Doctor Who phone is this? There's nerds in the house.
Zach, you're here?
Zach.
Of course.
Okay,
I know, so high tech.
Okay, the first question, just to kick things off, is obviously this is a very big year. It's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. So for all of you, sort of a challenge to make a movie that A, is going to honor the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, B, be the next level in this trilogy of films, and C, also be just a great action movie for people who are not fans or have never even seen a Star Trek movie before. Let's start. Simon?
Yeah, that was very important to us. Doug, Jung and I going in, and Justin, we wanted to sort of try and create a hybrid of an episode of the original series with, you know, a spectacular cinematic event. These films, the Star Trek movies, have always been event films. With the TV series, you get time to spend with the characters. It's a longer game. With the film, you kind of have to hit it. It has to be very self-contained. It has to be memorable. And so that was the thing, was to try and make sure everybody that's been here for 50 years gets what they deserve in terms of a good Star Trek film. But the people who've never seen it before, who perhaps aren't as familiar with Star Trek, they don't know about Kirk fighting, whatever you said, Scott, you know, then they're welcome too. This is an inclusive universe in every way, not just fictionally, but factually. Thank you.
Also, you know, you really shake things up in this one. You know, the dynamic, the Kirk-Spock dynamic has been explored twice before already, but now, definitely, going back to the old show, you have Spock and McCoy together a lot, and what is a good film like with great drama? So how was it for Zach and Carl to really spend a lot more time together and further explore that dynamic of these great characters?
He's getting ready.
Carl, you go first.
For me, I feel like this is probably the most fun that I've had making a Star Trek film. I think what Simon and Doug were able to do was present probably the most well-defined, well-rounded version of the character, and it certainly gave me a lot of material to work with. And I had an amazing time working with Zach, and I had a huge amount of respect for him and his approach, and it was just great to have those two characters that are so diametrically opposed to each other be forced into a situation where they have to depend on each other to survive, and through the process come to a deeper understanding of who they both are. It was obviously a great opportunity to explore a lot of comedy, but then to also really kind of deepen the relationship between the two, and I think that by the end of it they were able to go back to their respective corners with a bit of inside knowledge, and I think that it's for long-term fans a rewarding interaction.
Zach?
Well, I couldn't agree more, Scott. Props of all the words right out of my mouth. Literally, I gave all those exact same answers. I had a good time working together. You know, in a movie franchise where we're used to spending so much time together, all of us really, on the bridge of the Enterprise and in many of our adventures, it was actually really nice to have so many days where it was only Carl and me together, and I think we got to know each other and appreciate each other already more than we already did, which was already a significant amount. And and I think from a character standpoint, I really echo the idea that these two characters historically in this franchise are come at things from entirely different perspectives and points of view. And I think there's nothing more fun for fans of the original show to see that dynamic unmitigated by Kirk, who usually manages to get between them. And I think in the same way, you know, Bones really saves Spock's life in this film, and I think there's a deep appreciation for that, obviously. They end this film in a much better place as a duo than I would say they begin it.
Well, another thing that sort of is a throwback to the original show is the dynamic between McCoy and Kirk. In the beginning of the film, Chris, you have that scene in the bar where you're contemplating, what's it all mean? I mean, it was right out of a scene from The Corbomite Maneuver or Balance of Terror. So what was it like to just explore, now that you've been out in space, where the crew of the Enterprise, come on, you got the right model.
All right, you could be in the next film, Scott. Fine, you're in. Jeez.
Jeez.
Sort of not that the Enterprise has been out in space for 966 days, almost 3 years.
Did you get that reference, 966?
I got it.
Yeah.
Yes.
September 1966.
That's
yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. Wow.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
McCoy.
Did you deduce that on your own, seriously?
966, I got that.
You literally got 966.
Zach, that's Scott Mance you're talking to.
I know.
He had a Star Trek bar mitzvah.
But it's
come
like
on.
The limits of my—they just are always exceeding. Like, just when I think you can't get any nerdier.
Well, no. That moment when Spock is ailing. It was like that scene of Bread and Circuses.
And he's going to go there. He's going
to. Report says, I know why you're not afraid of dying. You're more afraid of living. I mean, come on. I'm your guy here.
You are.
But back to Kirk and McCoy. Let's talk about Chris. Where is Kirk 3 years into this mission? And he's not super excited about being a starship captain.
Yeah, I always have. The most fun in these films are either when we're laughing or talking. And then usually then shit blows up, and then we have to do the shit blowing up acting, which is, I think I spend the majority of the film saying, let's go. Can we do it? I don't know. And I'm just breathing heavily. So that scene in particular was one of my favorites. And I talked a lot with Simon about how to nuance the, or what particularly was Kirk's trip and this whole thing, and once we landed on the idea of him growing out of or moving out of underneath his father's shadow, that made a lot of sense, and to do it with Carl was great fun, and we had all that fun stuff with the whiskey and the vodka moment, which, you know, just like these just little itty bitty things that make us giggle and have a good time that hopefully people appreciate. And as you said, it's all these little nuance beats of the references and whatnot. So
that was improvised, by the way, when they were talking about, I thought he'd be a vodka guy. That all came out from those guys on the day, and that's the kind of super actors we get to work with as writers. It's like, sometimes you just go with it, and they do, and they come up with the best lines.
Well,
not always.
To the audience, by the way. Okay, why don't you start here with that?
As a fan of Beastie Boys, thank you that Sabotage ultimately beat the aliens. I might be alone in this, but I want to ask Simon, in your discussion with Justin and Doug, your position including this classical music, as Bone said.
That was Carl's joke. Say again, sorry.
What was the decision behind including this song?
We just love the idea of them foiling a technologically terrifying threat with something very analog and old, VHF, you know, it was like radio. The initial idea was that they fired an old radio into the middle of the swarm. It took many shapes as we wrote it, but we realized that was obviously there's no sound in space. We have to abide by physics some of the time. So it was just the idea that, you know, we liked the idea that Jayla had discovered this old ship that had an archive of music. She discovered rap music and liked it. You know, she says she likes the beats and shouting. And we like the fact that in the end they use it to kind of, you know, cause the swarm to have this big... And I like the fact that they all have the idea together about what it could do. And, you know, Sabotage was a song we used in 09, and it's part of Kirk's childhood. It all links... All these things links back to his past and his dad. The motorbike... The song, it's all kind of him letting go of these things, you know, and moving on as a man as well, so it's important for Kirk's character. But it's just a kick-ass song, you know? I mean,
yeah.
If anything's going to blow up a swarm of spaceships, it's going to be the Beastie Boys, come on.
Scott Hoover in the back.
film has such a lovely tribute to Leonard Nimoy, and I'm curious, was there initial expectation earlier on in the process that he would be part of the film before his passing, and how did you figure out how you wanted to pay homage to him?
When did Leonard die? It was during the writing process, wasn't it?
Yeah, he died on February 27th. I think, you know, if Leonard was well enough to be a part of this film, I'm sure he would have been, and I know that there were early conversations with him about that possibility, which, you know, true to his incredible self, he knew himself well enough to know that that wouldn't be possible at a certain point. And then I think it became important to all of us to figure a way to honor his legacy, and I thought Simon and Doug did a beautiful job of incorporating it into the narrative of the film. We all carried him with us through this production for sure, and it was definitely a different kind of feeling to make this movie without him, for me in particular. But I think he was very much a part of it in spirit and certainly in the film now, and will be a part of anything we do moving forward for sure.
We wanted to make it part of Spock's arc, Zach Spock's arc as well, not just a reference to Spock Prime or you know what we did eventually, with, of course, which was to dedicate the film to him. But we wanted to have his passing be something which inspired our Spock to move on as well, and so it became an integral part of the story, not just a kind of nod in Leonard's direction. That felt more right to do that.
Thank you. My question is for Mr. Simon. I heard the director say that the main reason he wanted to tackle this project is because his childhood dream sort of was to blow up the Enterprise and then bring it back together. Mm. So I'm wondering, was that a collaborative effort, or was that all his idea that he presented to you and then you guys developed it in the script?
I hated the idea at first. We had literally, I swear, we had like rows about it. Like I was shouting at him down the phone, going, you can't do that. You can't destroy the Enterprise. My problem was that if you think it's something new, then we've seen it before. It happened in Search for Spock. It happened in Generations. But Justin was like very, very determined. And as we spoke about it, I realized what he was doing brilliantly was he was not only sort of taking out a main character, but he was removing the physical connective tissue between the crew to see what happens when you take away the thing that physically bonds them together. You know, if you take away that thing that necessitates their being a unit, do they dissipate or do they come back together? And that was the genius of that thing. You take it away very violently and dramatically, and then you wait and see if they all come back together to be this family, which is essentially what they are. And of course they do. And I realized I backed down immediately and said, yeah, you're right, which I do occasionally do that, not always. But in this instance, I realized it was a brilliant idea. But yeah, initially I was opposed to it.
Zoe, can you talk a little bit about the evolution of your character and also her feelings for Spock in this movie?
She's tired. I think she's homesick. And I felt that's the one thing I appreciated the most about what Simon and Doug that did for this installment is that they made us human, you know, and just homesick and sad and how being overly worked and being away from home and all the things that keep you grounded can put a strain not just on the intimate relationships that you may have, but also, you know, the professional ones. And I thought I would never see the day where I would walk into the Enterprise and we're kind of like not rolling our eyes at each other, but we're not that, you know, excited to see each other. And I thought, okay, well, this is a great place to start because I can only imagine where we're going to end up. It's like, and we literally end up in the opposite direction. We're dying to be close to each other. We're dying to save each other and get back together. So I thought, okay, that's brilliant. And, you know, she's, I guess the relationship with Spock and Uhura felt so normal and human to me that it's sort of the consequences that may occur when you decide to love your coworker in a lovey-dovey way. And, you know, it just sometimes the professionalism can get in the way of the spirituality. And I feel like that's what happened between both of them. And I do have a feeling that it was probably like her decision to sort of go, listen, you have a lot of stuff that's about to start brewing and from your end, and I have to figure some stuff out. So it's probably just best.
That was your decision?
Be a gentleman.
Think of you need to.
Yeah. So is the relationship doomed, or do you have hope?
I mean,
I think it ends on a really hopeful note, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's go with hope.
But I mean, but if he were to walk in with some other Vulcan girl, or shit would go down, you know.
The Vulcan amulet would come right off.
So I wonder if anyone else could contribute to this, but since it is 50 years now since Star Trek began, it seems your character especially has gone through changes that sort of mirror women's changes, perhaps, in science fiction, in our culture and society. Can you talk a little bit about how you think she's evolved to what you're doing now, and anybody else from 65 to 2016 with this?
I think there's a beautiful, I hate using the word sprouting, but it's true. Women are becoming very, very independent. Not just in the workforce, but also in their personal lives. There's just something about like realizing that you should want to be a part of something. You don't necessarily have to be a part of something in order for you to be validated or respected or appreciated or considered strong enough. So I feel that this breakup that Uhura and Spock have is amazing, because she fell in love with her teacher. So he came as this figure that represented responsibility and safety and, you know, and maturity and wisdom. And now I think that she feels strong enough to, I mean, if I choose to see it that way, there is a parallel universe situation here that's going on with the Uhura and women these days, is that there's no longer this animosity or this resentment to sort of prove who you are. You just want to be alone. You just want to be left alone to sort of find out who you are, because you're interested in it, you're curious. So I like this autonomy that's happening with women right now, where there's it's, and I like when a battle is fought just with a spoken word, and nothing that feels tense or, you know, violent behavior or something. Physical. I guess I start to babble. I hope that answers.
You know, one of the questions that we were asked, for giggles on the tour in either Sydney or London, was which timeline would you choose to be in, the original series or ours, if you had the choice? And I did say ours if forced to choose, for this reason, like Roddenberry did set up a world, you know, that was incredibly progressive, but it was tempered by the social mores of the era, and I feel like we can go further in 2016 than he was able to do at the time. And to your point, I feel like
I know the fly legs what you're saying.
You know that our version is able to give more to the women and the people of color in the cast than Roddenberry was originally able to, I think.
And not because he didn't want to either.
Not because he didn't want to. Correct. Yeah, yeah.
He absolutely wanted to.
Yeah.
Well, let's go a little further with that, John, on how the character. on how Sulu has evolved, and really, like, when that idea came up on how to really get more background into Sulu's character.
The idea came up, I believe Simon pitched it, and then I was told of it through Justin pretty early on, and when he had set up at Paramount, and we went in to have a chat and get reacquainted. And I thought it was a beautiful idea. I had concerns about how it would be received by George. I had some other concerns, but it was really the handling of it that was most important to me. And having seen the film, I think its nonchalant posture toward it is the best thing about it. And the fact that it's normalized. And it comes, it's kind of news now, but if you rewatch the movie in 10 years, you won't think anything of it. It'll just go right by you. And that's the best thing about it. There's no music cue. There's no close-up. It's just...
Dun, dun, dun! He's gay!
Oh, people start running around screaming in your
He's
face.
Gay, everybody! He's with a man!
But I like the one thing that I guess has taken a secondary position is that it wasn't just that we revealed that he's gay, we revealed that he's a father. So none of our characters have families that we've ever talked about. So I actually feel quite puzzled that in 2016 we're having like a bit of a fit over who he fathered a baby with.
The point is,
I'm happy he's a dad. You know,
he had somebody on Yorktown. What the point of
the
that
point
in the story?
He was.
What we wanted to do was put somebody we care about in Yorktown. So when Yorktown was under threat, that made the threat tangible. We knew that Sulu's family was there, so it wasn't just a bunch of faceless Federation people. There was somebody there that we cared about too, because we care about Sulu. And that was really important thing. The nature of that relationship wasn't an issue. And by the way, the whole thing with George is, you know, people like to make things into a spat. George and I email all the time and have big, long, lovely discussions about it, and we're on great terms. It was never a kind of a... We were never shouting at each other or anything like that. It was just... And it's a great discussion to have. So I'm really happy with the way that it's been talked about and responded to, and I'm still a huge fan of GT, for sure.
Right here.
This film is a bit bittersweet with the loss of Anton. And Chris and John have spent quite a bit of screen time with him. What was it, this process working with him? And if anybody on the cast has heard from his family and their reaction to this film, what has their reaction been to Star Trek Beyond?
First of all, it's devastating to lose a family member. And... you know, we're at a point where we should be celebrating not only this film, but this beautiful man, this talented man. And for all of us, it is almost incomprehensible to be at the point where we have to talk about him in the past. The pain of his loss is still very raw. We can spend time with Anton's family, and we know that they will be very, very proud of his contribution to the film, and this film will forever be probably the most special experience for all of us. For, you know, it represents the golden period where our family was together, fully together for the last time, and it really was, as Simon said, the best summer of our adult lives. And we love him so much, we miss him terribly.
You know, in the original series, in episodes like Who Mourns for Outer Eyes, Gangsters of Triskelion, Spectre of the Gun, Kirk.
This is a bit, right?
Right. This is actually a follow-up, because Kirk was like a father figure to Chekhov. And in this movie, Chris, you got to spend a lot of time with Anton. So, like, what, in your opinion, this made him like a really special actor?
He was just a good guy. He was very sweet. He was very beautifully, authentically Anton. There was not much of a censor on the boy. And I remember one of the first times I met him, like 9 years ago, whatever, he was 17. And I invited him back to my trailer to play guitar, because I knew he'd play guitar, and he played guitar really, really, really well. And he said, "I can't, man, I gotta go back to my trailer." And I was like, "Okay, why?" And he was translating a, it wasn't like he was translating a, like an esoteric Russian novel into English, just because that's what he wanted to do. And 8, 9 years later, I talked to him, and he was still translating it, and he was still reading this book on physics that this French philosopher had written, and he was still trying to get all of us to go to these, like, he'd be in Vancouver, and he wanted to see some German neo-expressionist film that none of us, and he would talk about as if everyone has or should have seen it.
Well, Well, my husband was the only one that called him. He's like, hey, are we going to go see this movie? He's like, oh, I fell asleep.
I ended up going that night.
Did you?
You did.
I think.
He was a great guy. He was just totally fearless. And I think, you try to grasp onto something that's a positive out of losing such a... such a good guy, and I think it's just be fearless creatively. He was always working on stuff. He had music projects and photography projects. He was going to direct his first film this summer. He was just spectacularly interested in life in a really a great way. So,
who's got the next question? Right over there. Yeah.
This is for Simon. What would Tim Space like and dislike about this movie?
Well,
this
is for those of you who don't know, I started out in a sitcom in the UK called Space, and it was about a nerdy guy. I don't know what I was talking about. It wasn't me at all. But there's a line in Space where Tim says, as sure as eggs is eggs, as sure as day follows night, as sure as every odd-numbered Star Trek movie is shit. And I wrote that in 1998, I think. And then here we are in 2016, and I've written an odd-numbered Star Trek movie. I'm happy to say that Tim is wrong. It's an incredible thing to look back on the circularity of that, you know, of having grown up a fan of Star Trek and science fiction, to be now participating in such an active way. I tried to just make the kind of Star Trek movie Tim Bisley would like. You know, that's what Doug and I did. And when I say Tim Bisley, I'm talking about the people that have been with Star Trek for a long time, you know, because Star Trek must have been doing something right, because it's around for 50 years, and if it ain't broke, you know, don't fix it. So we wanted to embody the original show, instill it with what made the original show great, but also frame it in a big movie way, you know, which is a luxury they never had back in the day. That's why the series turned into such a great thing. Necessity was the mother of invention with that show. They had to make these wonderful little teleplays. They couldn't rely on special effects. Now we can do both, and it felt like, you know, I was always thinking, what would Tim Bisley think?
Front row right here.
The film felt like a throwback to the TV shows where you go on alien planets and fight. So what was it like for all of you being away from the con and in space and actually on foreign land fighting enemies?
I like being on the ship. It's
it's easier.
No, you don't understand. We were like in a quarry and... Ugh. It was just dust everywhere and helicopters flying really low and I like being on the Enterprise. It's cleaner.
It's more of
contemporary.
On the upside, it was cool to be paired off. So even though you were having a miserable time,
no. But you heard how much I was complaining. But I was so happy that I was complaining with you.
To get fractured off, you just it. You know, typically you're as characters relating on the bridge. Everyone's relating to Kirk, you know, so there's less talking to one another, and so just getting that opportunity brought out some different colors and vibes. So it was good.
Doug and I realized a couple of times, had Chekhov ever spoken to Sulu at any point in the other two movies, like directly to? We realized a couple of the characters hadn't really interacted at all.
There's a lot of panicky.
Yeah.
A little bit.
They were.
Like, looking at each other.
Don't give away the secrets.
Sorry, yeah. Again, look who you got here. All right, who's next? Bibbs.
I have actually kind of a similar question to the space question, but for Simon, you're kind of living the dream. You get to tell people in Star Trek what to do for all these years.
I asked them nicely.
Fair enough, but I don't know. Like, I have notebooks full of stuff that I would like to have done on my favorite shows and movies, and I was wondering, is there anything in Star Trek Beyond that you just always wanted to see in a Star Trek movie since you were young that you finally got to do and that was really important?
I think the kind of the business of writing a good story and making sure the plot worked, all that kind of superseded any kind of sort of wish fulfillment. We had to start with that, really. I mean, the whole splitting up the crew into different little interactive groups was nice. I loved the relationships in Star Trek, and it was nice to pursue those a little bit more, specifically, particularly with Bones and Spock, and as Chris mentioned, the scene with Kirk and Bones at the beginning, which is a kind of vague sort of parallel to the scene in Wrath of Khan when on Kirk's birthday when Bones and Kirk have that moment together. But it was just the whole thing, you know, getting the keys to that kingdom was a real joy, and it was nice to sort of be able to write our signature underneath the hundreds and hundreds of signatures that have gone into writing the Star Trek universe over the years. It was nice to put our little stamp on that and fill it with little Easter eggs that only we know about.
Right here. Since you guys were working with Justin this time around, you're a family in a different location, not in Los Angeles. You kind of have to rally together a little differently. What was the dynamic working with Justin compared to JJ?
I mean, Justin has a very different energy about him. I'd say he's a little more internalized, just as a person. He's a little quieter, but he's a little less confident. He's incredibly gifted as a visual storyteller, and I think he's really sensitive to character dynamics as well. He brings a balance of both of those extremes, and he came in on an already moving train in a lot of ways. You know, I mean, he didn't have a lot of time to prep for this film, and I think all of us were incredibly impressed by his sense of leadership and vision. And I think also it was really great to have Simon in a position of creative influence on this film, because he was a tremendous conduit for us early on before we kind of forged our own relationships with Simon, with Justin. But all in all, I mean, he was a really welcome addition, and I would say very different from JJ, but also really exciting and really unique in his own ways. And reflective of this experience, which was different and new for us to be away from the past and the configuration of the last two films. But we all had a great time working together. We really enjoyed him, and seeing what he was able to create in the final product is really exciting for all of us.
Back to the front row right here.
My question is about prop and costume. It's costumes vary since tape, so you had to see lunch sometime or any prop. If so, it's like the gadget looks like an old set form for me.
So tight around where? I think the pants were looser, right, guys?
Were fantastic this time. So much movement. A lot of space in the hips, which I appreciated. There was a lot of... I don't know how to answer your question, but I will say... I'm going to make up my own question and then answer that. But there was a lot of... this is kind of, it's like the retro super future version of Star Trek. So it's looking way ahead into what Star Trek can become, and also having very specific nods to the past. And one of the very small things is, like, throughout the three iterations of the film so far, there have been a lot of discussions about colors of yellow, for instance, for Kirk's shirt and the cut of the shirt. And this one is a very, a specific nod to the original series. It's not the kind of bright, fantastic yellow of the first and the second. It's this kind of, lovely Kirkian mustard green. So, I had a lot of lunch.
So you did an extraordinary job at costume design. And one of the things I was most proud of was the fact that, unlike the previous two films, that we got to do a JJ for whatever reason. I don't know what the reason, but the women in Starfleet uniforms in Star Trek Beyond all had ranks on the uniforms, which it's a fantastic thing, and a fan pointed out to me, and I was shocked that that wasn't the case. So one of the first things I did when I got got to Vancouver, was going to talk to Sonia about that, and she said, "Oh, yeah, don't you worry, women will have ranks." I think she did a great job.
Yeah.
He said what I was going to say. Throw back to the costumes, but then also making them slightly new. I have massive envy for Chris Pine's survival suit.
Yeah, but you get that just wonderful shade of blue, Carl. Makes you look lovely. That ruddy complexion of yours.
Right here, Scott.
So I have a two-part question.
Really?
With this how far do you see the franchise going now with these characters? And is there any, you know, thoughts of the spinoff with the next generation and so forth? And then also just the fun question of what was the greatest takeaway for each of you from this film? Like, what was the best moment you had with each other or in the pairs? Thank you.
Well, I hope it goes on for another 50 years, you know, and whether that's, we'll keep going as long as we can until we're old and inappropriate. Some of us already are, I say. But, you know, and who knows? Actually, the thing is about the new timeline is that Picard, Janeway, all those guys, they don't exist. I'm kidding. Man, would I be in trouble. Yeah, I hope it goes on. There's a new CBS series starting. It's all about, you know, the galaxy, let alone the universe, is a boundless place, and there's so many adventures to be had. And as long as we have this idea that, you know what, we might not just all kill ourselves and die in a big fire, we might actually become slightly more enlightened, slightly more tolerant beings and go off into space, that is a lovely idea that I think secretly the vast majority of us want to achieve, you know.
Longevity,
Star Trek would live forever. Yeah, longevity, absolutely.
Well, I just, you know, you just said something about, like, the next generation. Are you calling us old? We just got here. It's only been three movies.
I'm such a fan, I'm thinking all the way into the future.
Huh?
I'm thinking all the way into the future.
No, here's cooler. let's be present.
Stop wishing your life away.
The dirt abides.
Thank you very much. Hi, Mike from the Daily Japanese Daily News. I just want to touch very briefly on what you mentioned earlier. It's a beautiful comment, by the way, about 10 years not noticing anything different. I spoke to George this morning on the way in, and he and I were talking about how Star Trek.
That's weird, because he says that.
He says that sometimes. He's met the man. But he and Brian and I were talking about how the original Star Trek, because you mentioned they didn't have a lot of special effects to rely on, they relied as much on social commentary and reflective of the change at the time to sort of propel their story forward. In this day and age, I guess the question is, what can the message be now? I mean, you know, in the Oscar so white realm of things, and I look at this cast, and what can the message for Star Trek be in 2016 to help propel it forward? Like you said, perhaps for another 50 years.
Well, I mean, I think the message is the same as it was when it began. It's just that we have more room to explore and express it than they did at the time. You know, it's shocking to me how divisive our culture has become, and I feel like Star Trek maintains a position of inclusivity and unity that is as resonant today as it was in the late 60s. You know, this film in particular explores that idea, one side of that being about the unity and inclusivity and the other being about breaking that apart, and I think that's in a way really reflective of the society we live in today. It's troubling to me on such deep levels that we've gotten to this point of unwillingness to see varied points of view or feelings or opinions or perspectives. And I think that Star Trek remains in a landscape of popular culture entertainment, something that is a beacon of inclusivity and progressive thinking.
I think it just takes on different forms now than it did 50 years ago.
I think the film is actually even more opposite. It's become more so in the last, even since we shot it. Mm. You know, the message of this, the social commentary in this iteration of Star Trek is we're better together. That's what it's about. It's about collectivism. And in this era of Brexit and talking about building walls in certain places, you know, now more than ever we should be thinking about the value of collectivism, about cooperation and, you know,
unity.
That's our, that can be and is our strength. And the more fractured we become, the less secure we all feel, you know. So, yeah. You know, the villain in Star Trek is like, we could have called him Brexit. It's quite a science fiction name, isn't it? Sorry.
I'm just saying, you know, like when you go into, you know, in the Star Trek setup, you're going into space and seeing so many different kinds of species. It does become comically apparent when you look around the planet Earth that we live on that we do have so much more in common than we don't, you know. So it, you know, the little things that seem to divide us here in our present time seem even more exaggeratedly small after seeing, you know, an episode of Star Trek. So
we've all got one head. Do you know what I mean? Let's live together. Next question.
Last question right here.
Well, I just want to talk about Sophia for a second because I thought she was pretty kick-ass in this. And what moves did she show you, Simon, on any kind of action moves?
Sophia's incredible. She's because she's a dancer, and so she's physically so adept. So she was very up for, you know, the physicality of it. It's funny. I told this story the other day that when we, Doug and I and Justin in the writing room, wanted to create this very independent female, very resourceful character on the Ultimate Surface, and we were trying to get a point. We didn't have a name for her, so we used to call her Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone. That was her long name, and so we thought, okay, so Scotty lands there, and then suddenly Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone comes out, she fights these guys, and it started to get tiring, always saying Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone. It's a long name. So then we started calling her J-Law, and then she became J-Law. So J-Law is basically named after Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone. But yeah, there aren't enough girls in Star Trek. You know, Zoe has a lot on her shoulders, as you know. And so we wanted to increase that. And also with Commodore Paris, you know, as a figure of extreme authority. Yeah, Sophia, we all love Sophia, don't we? She's a nutcase and a golden addition to this group. So... she's awesome. Anything to add?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Star Trek Beyond opens July 22nd, a week from Friday. Thank you so much, Kyle.